Hey, everybody. This is Ricky Herbst, Cinema Program Director, and I'm here recording with Kevin Krismanich, our Tech Director, in the state-of-the-art Browning Cinema in the lovely DeBartolo Performing Arts Center on the bucolic campus of the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, St. Joe County, Indiana. Thank you very, very much for listening. We are continuing our way through the six modes of documentary proposed by Bill Nichols, and this week we are taking a look at observational documentaries. There are many, many metaphors for thinking about observational documentaries, and I will surely mix and mangle them throughout this week, but I think the one that is easiest to remember, even if it has some misleading connotations, is that observational documentaries are the fly-on-the-wall subgenre. And we all certainly have times when we say to ourselves how interesting it would be to be a fly on the wall for certain meetings, events, conversations, the ability to simply sit back and observe unobtrusively to some fascinating set of events, even if mundane, in real time. Now, imagine if you were a fly on the wall and also got to record that meeting, event, or conversation or whatnot and got to show it to the world. Sounds like a pretty tantalizing proposition, eh? That opportunity opened itself to documentary filmmakers in the wake of World War II. You'll be right to notice a pattern in how much theorizing about why documentaries should be made certain ways seems to track with the technology available. Again here, Veritas' idea of the camera machine as augmentation of our artistic abilities rings true. And in the 1950s, there are advancements in film cameras that lead to a very new genre hitting mainly during the 1960s. Prior to World War II, synchronized sound comes about, but both the film cameras required to record the image and the sound recorders used in parallel are very, very clunky and very, very loud, too. You really needed controlled environments, for example, a sound stage, to ensure your image and sound were going to fit together neatly. As engineers kept refining the machinery to eliminate those problems and make the machines as less inhibitive as possible, the ability for filmmakers to record sight and sound unencumbered from a large crew and conditions grew. Come the 1960s, a very light film crew, even one person acting alone, could record in the field footage with synced sound. The world that was available to be recorded grew exponentially. The flies on the wall could fly freely. This freedom to roam allows documentary filmmakers to tackle a wide array of subjects through different means. Think of how poetic documentaries use image supported by non-diegetic sound, for example, the soundtrack of Samsara, to evoke the truth in the world. Conversely, think of how expository documentaries use voiceover to convey information ideas that are needed to tie together the images, which are being used to support or reinforce the narrated arguments. Neither relied on synced sound, as it wasn't an option when the filming of Trains of England or Inuits of Alaska or other various topics at the outset of documentary films. Now in the 1960s, the whole world suddenly becomes a film studio. Think about the excitement and feeling of freedom that would have been delivered to a new set of documentary filmmakers. Now, documentary filmmakers could film events as they happened. That seems so raw, right? No buffer between the world as it happens and the experience of the audience. Well, there are buffers, including a wide array of choices of what is seen or unseen, edited out, edited in, etc. But you can imagine how a young documentary filmmaker could be wooed by these technological advancements and the freedom they provided. Filtering that chance another way, think of Veritas' six-step process for making a documentary. Step one, go and see the world. Step two, think about the world. Step three, film the world. Step four, edit that world. Step five, see what's missing and go out and refilm. And step six, edit and distill until your film is done. Observational filmmakers now have the ability to consolidate steps one through three. A person could go out and see the world and film it simultaneously. Think also what types of people are going to be compelled by the new technology and the ability to capture events, quote-unquote, as they happened, with no disturbance. You're likely going to find a more journalistic ethos to those people. And even if not, the subgenre of observational documentary coalesces around the idea that the filmmaker will not engage the scene. I often think about people who take pictures at crime scenes. It is of utmost importance that they not interact with the scene as to not disturb the evidence. Likewise, observational documentary films stay close to their expository and poetic cousins in keeping the filmmaker as someone who does not disturb the scene, stays a fly on the wall, and wants to shoot a record of events that reflects reality. And in that reality is truth, they would posit. Compare that to Kino Pravda or how expository documentaries attempt to tell you the truth. Observational documentaries, like journalists, are less interested in presenting direct argumentation. Think of poetics and expositories as the opinion pages and observational documentary filmmakers as beat writers. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't subjectivity in observational docs or in some pretty direct arguments are being made. But the goal is not to make a persuasive film. Given the maintained invisibility of the filmmaker in observational films, just like poetic and expository docs, it's worth noting some of the other shifts that will lay the groundwork for some of the following subgenres while also framing the hallmarks of observational documentaries. As I've been saying, you'll notice in observational documentaries that expository voiceovers and poetic embellished soundtracks are both gone. Instead, there is the sound of the event, a doubling down on the reality of the moment. Historical reenactments or seeing what is missing and reenacting that event in order to create glue between the scenes that we see in expository and poetic documentaries, those are out the window. Observational documentaries push in many ways to be seen as chronological and, above all else, not staged. Their capital is largely set by the idea that you are able to watch life unfold unencumbered. If they were the ones refolding events just so that they could unfold again, think, for example, the stage scenes in Nanook of the North, then that would depreciate their stock tremendously. Now, that's not to say that didn't happen with some films, but the manifesto of the observational documentary would not encourage that. Similarly, splicing in another set of realities to speak to the events isn't happening. When a person is rejected by a lover at a prom, there isn't a cut to a nuclear mushroom cloud as there might be in a poetic documentary. The footage tends to be sealed to the events pertaining directly to the subject at hand. And the chronological nature of the film often makes sense given the filmmaker was alongside a subject for the course of whatever their day or event might be. The filmmaker has a similar set of experiences to the subject as to what is being caught on film, allowing them to edit or allowing them to direct their editor to piece together the material as you might greatest hits from a journal you keep about your own life. The topics we find in observational documentaries are also key. Oftentimes, they involve people who are engaged in a task or process that is going to keep them distracted, by and large, from the camera. An example there might include Primary from 1960, an incredibly important film that signals the beginning of the observational documentary epoch in many ways. With great access to the Democratic nominees vying for the presidential nomination, Primary chronicles JFK and Hubert H. Humphrey as they seek votes in the 1960 Wisconsin primary. Two very important voices in observational documentaries were key to the film, and you can see the subgenre get its legs in Primary. Albert Maysles produced it, and we'll see his work later in Grey Gardens, and D.A. Pennybaker edited it, and think of the importance of editing all of that 16mm footage people were able to get. Shooting in both large arenas and more intimate moments, the handheld cameras were able to give people a glimpse into the campaign trail and the conversations and the nerves and the energy that otherwise had not been seen in the cinema. It was, again, borrowing from the Hamilton line, an opportunity to be in the room where it happens, both during the raucous and the more quiet moments. And being able to see the minutiae is a chance to observe human behavior, to look through a keyhole, as Nichols says. It certainly is voyeurism, especially given that the social actors, here the Kennedy and the Humphrey campaigns and the people who are seeing them, have much larger fish to fry than worrying about the filmmakers. Flies on the wall still buzz, but when there's all the other lights and cameras and flesh to press, it's easy to begin to hear that buzz as white noise or not even notice it at all, which perhaps feeds the audience's scopophilia, the love of looking, and pushes it towards voyeurism. The narrative of observational films is also something of note. Just as a beat writer creates a story, observational documentaries find some hook and follow it, which makes a political campaign a natural and compelling subject to follow. Here, the work of Frederick Wiseman is important. Wiseman graduated from Yale Law School, known for educating people about film, if not the law, and adopted an observational approach to his documentaries with a deep interest in institutional processes and how humans interact with those. He started his career with two major films, Titty-Cut Follies, about conditions in a mental institution, and a film that went through a lengthy and fascinating censorship process, and High School, about a day in the life of a high school in the Philadelphia area. High School, in particular, gained prominence for how it laid bare the interactions between teachers and students and how the institution itself molded students. It wasn't a 2020 exposé, that would be more of an expository, but it did expose, through editing and selecting certain scenes and themes, some unspoken qualities about high schools and the power dynamics within them. Wiseman's films actually would have been a first choice for this class, for this screening, but we have shown so many of his films, including Ex Libris about the New York Public Library system last year, and High School in our 1968 class, and we will be showing Monrovia, Indiana, his newest film, about the small town of roughly 1,000 people here in Indiana. That's why we went elsewhere for our film this week. Of note is that Wiseman is an incredibly adept editor. He gets a lot of footage, hours and days of this stuff, and his skill is editing it into a cogent pattern that brings forward the essence of what he's observing in a way that doesn't make it dull. For example, the New York Public Library system could be incredibly dry. He gives it life. Oftentimes, his films run long. I think the runtime on State Legislature, his film about the Idaho State Congress, is something like 7 hours long. So it might seem like he isn't editing, but he is constantly distilling the film into a cohesive piece. And he's aware of the subjectivity in that. He said, quote, "You have to edit the material. That assumes that some kind of a mind is operating in relation to the material. Not all minds are the same. Every aspect of filmmaking requires choice. The selection of the subject, the shooting, editing, and length are all aspects of choice," unquote. So he's tuned deeply to the subjectivity of something that of a genre that appears to be an objective genre. Institutions and processes work well for observational documentaries because they need to carry on. They can't stop and recognize the film as easily, which made them a fertile playground for Wiseman. The last subject material that makes for a common observational documentary that I'd like to note is the concert film, including our film this week, Buena Vista Social Club, which comes from a long tradition and from a director who often floats in and out of different forms. As for concert films, one problem observational documentaries potentially encourage is just how much consent would someone in a film be able to offer, given that they don't know how their story will ultimately be portrayed or judged against the context of the film or through the lens of history. And that's not endemic to concert films. That's all observational documentaries. If someone on the street says, sure, you can film me painting this house, they don't know if the film is ultimately about gentrification, making them look complicit, or if the brand of paint they're using will 20 years later be found out to be toxic, making them look bad. You get the idea. Concert films work well because a band has shown up to perform, but there is work and effort involved in the concert, something observational films often love unpacking. That is the skill of someone doing their work, completing their daily life. Also, you have an audience who is performing excitement in their own way, off of which the film's audience can feed. Lastly, there's so much going on that it makes it very easy for the filmmakers to go unnoticed as their buzz can't be heard above the excitement. Now, that doesn't mean the band isn't aware of the recording and so gives a more outlandish performance, or that the audience knows that it is being filmed and therefore screams more loudly, gives longer ovations. But generally, the observation filmmaker can become a ghost among the spectacle. This is seen in D.A. Pennebaker's Monterey Pop from the concert in 1968 California, Woodstock the movie about the 1968 festival, and Give Me Shelter, again with Albert Maysles having his hand in it, with some others, about a Rolling Stones tour in which the filmmakers caught the events of the tour and concerts as they happened, including one particular scene at the Altamont Free concert in which a concert goer, Meredith Hunter, attempted to get on stage and was blocked by the Hell's Angels, who were running security. When Hunter brandished a gun, one of the Hell's Angels attacked Hunter with a knife, stabbing and killing him in footage that made the final edit of the film. You can see very quickly from this example the ethical questions that might arise from someone undertaking an observational documentary. When do you insert yourself in the scene you are recording? Is there a duty to show events that otherwise would not be seen? What respect is owed people who unwittingly become a major focus of your film? So it is from that tradition of concert documentaries that Buena Vista Social Club comes. Not the violence, I mean, but the concert footage as observational documentary sub-subgenre, as it were. Wim Wenders, a German filmmaker known for both narrative films, for example, his drama Paris, Texas won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, and for his documentaries, for example, his new documentary on the papacy called Pope Francis, A Man of His Word. His documentary style is not squarely observational, although often invokes it. In this film, Roy Cooter, himself a famous American musician who worked with Wenders on the Paris, Texas soundtrack, pulled together a group of pre-revolution Colombian musicians to create an album after falling in love with the music while they're on a different project. Wenders came on board to document the collaboration and the accompanying tour the musicians took. In particular, the film captures performances from two locations while the group was on tour for its 1997 album, with one in Amsterdam and one in New York City. Buena Vista Social Club, as an album that launched a film that in turn made an album that you couldn't write a paper in early 2000s college without hearing in dorm rooms, coffee shops, or anywhere else, and I'll testify to that, follows many of the tropes of observational documentaries. Watch for how the camera goes unnoticed. If there are eyes directly looking into the camera in Samsara, see how they largely are not being trained on the camera in Buena Vista Social Club. Also, see how the information about the music, about Cuba, about the history of the social clubs is given to you. Does it come from the narrator, the voice of God? Does it come from a feeling you get from watching it from juxtapositions? Or does it take a more evidentiary approach, a more journalistic approach in recording it? Put another way, does the filmic experience have the fingerprints of the director on it in the same way you saw in Central Park 5 and Samsara? Sure, there are obvious touches from the filmmakers and choices that were made. For example, what songs were selected, what conversations are highlighted, what political issues aren't raised. But you should find some noticeable differences between how Wenders creates a reality out of his story compared to Samsara and Central Park 5. Lastly, I think Bill Nichols' description of the press conference as the inverse of the observational documentary is incredibly, incredibly important. Even if not applied to the Buena Vista Social Club, which I'll do in a little bit, thinking of those who go out to capture reality through an observational documentary as a way of giving permanence to ephemeral events, giving a second life to something already happening, and then seeing the converse. That is how, in a press conference, the reality is happening strictly for the cameras. It is performing information and a sense of reality strictly because the cameras are present. That awareness of a press conference's raison d'etre is so powerful, I think, and speaks to humans' abilities and desire to adapt quickly to cameras as an audience member. That's something to remember. Now, almost 60 years after the film Primary, and with countless seasons of Big Brother and Survivor and so forth, people have an idea of how they should perform themselves organically, which doesn't make it organic. That's worth considering and keeping in mind while watching Buena Vista Social Club and any other film that appears to have observational documentary overtones, and also will be of importance in our next three subgenres. With that, big thanks as always to Kevin Krizmanich for the audio engineering and Stacey Stickovich for the online engineering. I look forward to seeing you next Wednesday when we get the band back together for Dos Gardenias para ti.